the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. And joining us on the phone, Dr. Gary Yeo. He is a Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Dr. Yeo has, well, first of all, Dr. Yeo, thank you so much for joining us this morning and holding on to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for finding me.
Well, you're not hard to find. You've authored nearly 150 articles and some books about climate change and climate issues, and most notably, you're the co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize as a senior member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, for both the third and fourth assessment reports. And we will get into that, all of that. So I wanted to start here, though. You studied mathematics and economics through college, got your PhD in those areas. And then back in 1983, I believe, you co-authored a paper with William Nordhaus looking at carbon emissions in the atmosphere. Was that one of the first papers that you were aware of? Where did that come from?
It started in late 1981, 1982. Bill Nordhaus was a reader of my PhD dissertation, which was on prices versus quantities, otherwise known as cap and trade versus carbon taxes, though I didn't know it at the time. But I graduated. I was at Wesleyan University by then, and Bill phoned me up one day and said, would you like to be part of a National Academy of Sciences committee study on greenhouse gas warming and climate change? And I said, sure, that sounded like a plan. Mm-hmm. I've never looked back. That's when it started. There was just so much to do and so much essentially low-hanging fruit for a very long time. Our study was one of the first. Bill had published a slightly earlier study framing the problem as an enormous public goods under uncertainty and an enormous time frame difficulty, and we just went from there.
Right, because back then I was a grad student in environmental engineering, and my air pollution class was focused on acid rain, let's say, as an example, sulfur mm-hmm. and nitrogen oxides, and those impacts and the acid rain that was affecting. I'm looking at Nell, who grew up in the Adirondacks.
That's right.
Many of the lakes. That's right. And so that's where the focus was. Not much talk about carbon dioxide back then.
That's right, and certainly no recognition that carbon emissions, greenhouse gas pollution, is an entirely different character of pollution than nitrous oxide and sulfur oxide that cause acid rain. Carbon dioxide is a stock problem in the jargon. It means that it depends, the temperature increases depend on concentrations, and concentrations depend on cumulative emissions. And that means that climate impacts really don't have a chance to disappear. The climate will not change back in a human lifetime, particularly. But for acid rain, if you stop throwing the sulfur into the air and give it a little bit of time and maybe throw some baking soda in the lake, the fish come back.
Right. So much easier.
It sounds so simple.
Yeah. Impact and response to that. And actually, it seemed to work because there were regulations or systems put into place to control sulfur and nitrogen emissions from coal-fired power plants, let's say.
That's right. And they did set up a cap-and-trade program.
Ah, so it was cap-and-trade that succeeded addressing those two compounds.
I'm an economist, so for me, the cap-and-trade success is not only that we managed to reduce emissions of dangerous things, but also got people to accept that economics and market systems can be used to efficiently accomplish an environmental objective.
Okay. Well, I think we'll circle back to cap and trade versus, you know, carbon tax in relationship to carbon emissions. I want to continue forward. Like you say, off you went through the 80s and 90s. You continued to write and work on climate change issues. When did you get invited to join the IPCC?
Good question. that was around... the turn of the century. I was involved in the third assessment report, the fourth, and the fifth. And the third assessment report came out in 2001. And it takes about two or three years for authors to complete the report. At the very beginning of that process, there was a special meeting in San Jose, Costa Rica, on adaptation, and I was invited to that. And that was my first dabbling my toes into IPCC stuff.
So you, like say, co-author, among other things, the third and fourth assessment reports. What is the an assessment report?
The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change was ratified in the by 160 countries or so towards the end of the 1980s, and they took upon themselves to commit to reducing or holding concentrations below a limit that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system. And they decided that if they were to negotiate that, they should know something about the science, so they created the IPCC and told it that every 6 years or so, they should collect a lot of scientists from around the world, read all of the new and previous literature again, and come up with assessments about various findings, the state of the up-to-date state of the science about what climate change was doing, what was causing it, how it was being generated, what the impacts were, and things like that, as well as think about what would be the implications of responding this way or responding that way. But the IPCC was forbidden from making any policy prescriptions. That was up to the countries. So we had to stop at the boundary there. Notwithstanding the fact that we frequently tried to step over it and always got it, mixed a metaphor, always got our hands slapped.
Right. Well, you know, that's... That seems to be, in hindsight, an endeavor that was well measured at time, I guess. But you know, you in these assessment reports, there were efforts to kind of predict or model out what might happen as carbon dioxide concentrations increase in the atmosphere. What type of temperatures would we see? What type of temperature rise we would see? What were the models saying back then, you know, in 2000, 2005, with respect to where we would be today at 2020? Mm-hmm.
That's actually a really good question. I do have one small bone to pick. We're a little allergic to the word predict.
Ah.
We tend to try to project, and that's why we generate distributions of what the future might look like.
Oh, so okay. So I'm sorry. There's a difference between predict and project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I predict the Dodgers are going to win the World Series. It may, you know, it's plus or minus or something, but early in the season, I would have projected that they were certainly a playoff team.
I get it. Okay.
Something like that.
I like that.
Okay. Sports metaphors
good
always work here.
Good. So what was going on? the turn of the century, models were doing the best they could to characterize the best science in the various systems that contribute to the climate. There's economic systems, there's physical systems, there's natural systems, there's the atmospheric climate system. And you have to try to put all that together and let it run together and move it forward. And in so doing, you have to make a variety of assumptions about what's actually going on. And so the idea that the IPCC came up with, and also the World Climate Research Program, is don't just believe one model, get as many as you can and create an ensemble and see what ranges they project into the future. And back then, in terms of temperature increase, they were thinking that in 2020, we would be up to about 6/10 or 7/10, maybe almost 8/10 of a degree Celsius. 9/5 times that is what it is in Fahrenheit. So if it's 5 degrees Celsius, it's 9 degrees Fahrenheit. But there was a range from, you know, maybe 8/10 of a degree centigrade down to maybe 4/10 of a degree centigrade, depending on what model you used and how you thought the future would evolve, what the emissions trajectories would look like. Turns out the size of the range was about right, but they were a little low. They were a little conservative, and the IPCC has frequently been criticized for being too conservative because you're really striving for a consensus, an idea that everybody in the room, all the authors in the room, agreed to a finding and a degree of confidence that you have that the finding is in fact true.
Right. So I wanted to emphasize, and you say that they were a little low, meaning you kind of underestimated the projection, or the projections kind of underestimated what we're experiencing right now.
Right, that's right. Where we are right now is within the range of projections from the turn of the century, but it's on the very upper part of the range, nowhere near the middle for the best guess. And nowadays, the best guess, the middle of the range, is a little bit higher, a couple tenths of a degree higher. If the countries of the world or the United States were to sign on to a 2-degree temperature target or a 1.5-degree temperature target, as indicating what dangerous anthropogenic interference would look like, a tenth of a degree is quite a bit. Mm. It's, you know, starting in 2000, we were at 6/10. If it's 0.9 instead of 0.8, that's 0.1 of 0.9 that we have left to go. So we're spending our money pretty fast on this one. There's a limit to the cumulative emissions, and we're eating it up.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Gary Yeo. He's the Huffington Foundation Professor of Environmental and Economic Studies at Wesleyan University and Emeritus Professor. And also, he co-authored a number of papers for the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change, shared in a Nobel Prize for those efforts. And today we're talking about kind of the history of climate change research, but also wanting to connect that to what we're seeing in our world today. One of the things we wanted to talk to you about was this kind of horrific Western wildfire season, and ask, you know, can you directly connect these wildfires to climate change at this point?
I can connect the intensity of them, and probably at least in California, know more about the time record than Colorado and the other side of the mountains, but the frequency as well. And the idea is that there are a number of stories about why wildfires have increased in frequency and intensity. Some of them involve development patterns by human beings. Some of them involve fire management practices and whether or not you rake the forest. Some of them involve electrical wires being vulnerable to high winds and potential sparking that would do that. Those are confounding factors to an explanation that wildfires have been affected by climate change. Climate change doesn't cause wildfires, but it makes the ambient temperature hotter. It makes the moisture lower. It can change the wind patterns. And that on its own over time has caused an increase in the number of fires and then occasionally a record fire. 2017 was the worst year in California history. 2018 had a new worst ever fire in California. And 2019 was pretty benign relative to those two, and then 2020 happened. I know you have the two largest fire in Colorado history burning at the same time. California had five of the top six fires burning at the same time, plus number 18, if you're wondering about who's breaking into the lower end of the top 20 ranking. and why is that? Okay, so that is a dramatic change in the intensity. And to explain a change, you have to find something that's changing a lot. And development patterns aren't changing that fast. Management practices aren't changing that fast. What has changed is that some of the climatic factors that fires depend on, like drought, have in recent times, the last year or two, reached record proportions. Heat waves have reached record proportions. Someplace around Colorado and Wyoming, the hottest place in the continent over the last 40 years happens to live. Pine bark beetles have infested forests and killed 85-90% of the trees in particular areas and turning them into matchbox and tinder. Right. Air currents have changed, moved the humidity north along the coast, and created a propensity of dry lightning strikes and huge numbers of dry lightning strikes. And all of these are therefore sort of the end of the distribution of the extreme impacts of the changing climate, all happening at the same place at the same time, and they amplify each other. And so it just looks like it exploded, and because that's what it did, and that's because of climate. Nothing else can explain this change. You can look right at the president and say, I can explain this by climate. What's your explanation? You think climate is going back? It's not.
Well, it would seem like their explanation is more focused on management issues.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. We need more rakes and lots of people.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, you mentioned climate change can be pointed towards fire season's intensity and frequency. How about duration? Is the duration of wildfire seasons a consequence of a warmer world?
Yeah.
So,
yes.
Okay.
Yes, there's a conclusion in Cal Fire that their fire season is 75 days longer than it was 10 years ago.
Wow.
By the way, all of the fires that they experienced, from all of those fires that I mentioned, started after August 1st, and they were all burning on October 1st. That was before the Santa Ana winds really kicked in, as well before they showed up. Apparently, they have just shown up.
Yes.
Huge erupting fires in Southern California all of a sudden.
Yeah, this is, as I understand it, this is actually the prime season for fires in at least Southern California with the Santa
That's
Ana
right.
winds. This is the end of October, November, as you're saying. The seasons now are almost 12 months long in California. And you also saw near record fires in Oregon and Washington too. So up and down the West Coast, greater vulnerability.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
even
The highest number of acres burned until 2020 in California was 1.6 million. And they have just very nearly cut close to 8.0 million acres this year. That's what? Not breaking a record. That's just starting a new page.
It's shocking. We're speechless. We're staring at each other, motioning with our hands.
It's not good radio. But
but if you could see our faces. But I think, you know, your point is well taken. It's also something I think that we need to, you know, that rapid growth trajectory is something that we probably need to be thinking about here in Utah. For the first time that I can remember, and Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, we got a warning from our power company that some of the lines may be shut down because of extreme fire danger here in Park City, Utah, which we think of up in the mountains, you know, a cool alpine climate. But that's changing, and now we're trying to think about the same level of risk.
Right.
I imagine that's kind of happening throughout the West. It's no longer just what we've thought of as these hot spots. It's everywhere.
It is. There's something like 350,000 people in Southern California had Northern California, I think. I'm not sure. Someplace in California that had their power shut off yesterday.
Yeah. And another thing that's really interesting, going back to a warmer world, is that here in Utah, some of our local climate experts have been talking about here, we've already passed the 2 degrees C mark. We're 3 to 4 degrees warmer in the Mountain West, maybe in the ranges here in Utah. But a lot of that is being expressed by warmer nights. Not necessarily warmer days, which are also occurring, but it's really warmer nights that is driving warming overall. Is that something that you see across the board?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and everybody thinks, heat causes heat waves, and that's really bad. And 110 degrees and 2 in the afternoon is evidence of the risk. It's actually that the low temperature never gets below like 85 or not 88, and human beings, animals, trees, plants, that whole assortment of living things that populate the planet. Are used to having cool nights so that they can recover from the temperature of the sunshine, the day. And that's being taken away from them, and it makes them, sort of a pre-existing condition for all of the risks that they face from the upper extreme of the distribution.
Right, and for example, the bark beetle, warmer winters, so to speak, the bark beetle typically can't survive temperatures, what is it now, below 10 or 15 degrees below zero. You need extended evenings of temperatures that cold to kill off the bark beetle. Well, those days are few and far between, or less and less, let's say.
Right.
And that allows the beetle to survive, which then allows it to proliferate, which then, you already have drought situations where the pines and firs are under stress. The bark beetle comes along. It's an easy meal. And now you have square miles, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of square miles here in Utah that are, forests that are bark beetle infested and basically dead. And like you say, tinder. We've been really lucky not to have our own large outbreaks.
Mm-hmm. Just because you're lucky, don't want to be spreading bad news, but just because you've been lucky doesn't mean it won't happen. It strikes me that uncertainty around climate, uncertainty around the virus has always been, if this happens, I might get really sick, and if I get really sick, I'll have to go to the hospital, and I might die in terms of the virus. Or if one of these extreme events happens where I live, if a fire happens to break out in Utah, it's now going to be worse than probably one would have expected in Utah 15 or 20 years ago or 10 years ago. But that's if this happens then. But it strikes me that one of the things we know is that in the next minute, 35 more Americans are going to be infected by the virus, and some of them will have a serious case, and some of them will die. That's not if then. That's if when. When this happens. Mm-hmm. Something bad will happen. And similarly, I don't know where the next extreme weather-related, fire-related, hurricane-related, climate-driven event is going to happen somewhere around the world. But I do know it's coming, and I know it's going to be more likely than not, more severe than expected, and maybe even more severe than ever before.
Well, you know, you mentioned that, and I was just kind of about to ask, what is our trajectory moving forward on this look like? I think we can probably guess it's not great. But along with that, we're burning such massive, massive swaths of land in these forest fires right now. When have we kind of like run out of this initial, you know, land to burn? Are there estimates of that?
Yeah, good insight. The National Climate Assessment, the third one that I was vice chair of, a couple people at Arizona State had done some modeling, and the incidence frequency and damage caused by wildfires in the western part of the United States went up and up and up, and then about 2025, 2030, it went down precipitously. And the reason was that the fires ran out of fuel. There was nothing to burn.
Right.
Wildly different landscape left in its wake.
Yes.
Well, haven't we talked about bark beetle situations where the bark beetle infestation has actually dropped off in some areas of Utah because there's literally no more wood,
fuel.
There's no more trees to eat. So
yeah, I mean, that just makes sense. Sure,
but their
range expands. Those of us who live in Connecticut are a little bit concerned that, you know, as they go north, they might get up to the boreal forest, and the boreal forest goes all the way over to the Atlantic Ocean, so they could wander over to see us.
All right,
it might take a while.
Yes,
we hope not.
But we've got a few more minutes. Let's talk about mitigation. And you've written quite a bit about areas of mitigation. Where do you see our best hope lies in trying to either reduce carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere or employing acts of mitigation along, say, the coast or the forest to reduce impacts?
Right. Mitigation is a perfectly good word in the English language, but in the climate world, it means reducing emissions or taking carbon greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. The response along the shoreline or in the forest and things like that is adaptation. You look at a risk that's coming, and you make investments in projects and plans and procedures and behavioral changes that ameliorate the risk. With that said, one of the conclusions that I'm most proud of the IPCC is that responding to climate change involves iterative risk management that speaks to adaptation and mitigation. So it's really risk. It's not a cost-benefit problem. Risk is likelihood times consequence, so you can begin to think about it in terms of reducing the likelihood that something bad will happen or the consequences of something bad will happen. So mitigation is reducing emissions of greenhouse gases or taking them out of the air to the degree possible, slowing the pace of the warming, and therefore slowing the pace of the impacts as they get more frequent and more intense. And so what that's doing is reducing the likelihood of really bad events occurring. That's its job, and it's all hands on deck. We're going to have to wean herself out of fossil fuel. I thought the brouhaha about Biden's comment during the debate is a little bit misguided. We're going to have to transition out of oil. It doesn't have to happen. It could happen suddenly later on and be very, very expensive, or it could go much more gradually and with some degree of anticipation, and the costs to unemployment and stuff won't be nearly as bad. But solar, wind power, alternative energies, smart grids, all hands on deck in terms of providing alternative energy sources that slow the pace of emissions and get it to the point, and it has to be about 80% below where we are now, the concentrations stop going up, and that's when the climate has been stabilized. Adaptation is the other thing, and what it works on in these investments, reduce the consequences. You see what you're vulnerable, how you're vulnerable, what things you've done to make yourself more vulnerable than necessary, and make adjustments in those sorts of things. In both cases, you won't be completely successful in adaptation. There will always be residual damages, and the economics say the cost of climate is then the cost of the adaptation plus the damages that you haven't been able, or in fact efficiently didn't make sense to try to guard against. In mitigation, at least you have a story of what success looks like. Stabilized concentrations caused by emissions that have been reduced sufficiently that cumulative emissions of carbon don't go up anymore.
Right. Okay. So mitigation, reduce the amount of carbon that we introduce the atmosphere. Adaptation, we raise the level of the road to address the rising sea levels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an ongoing maintenance issue, which has
massive costs.
Yeah, well, just look at the Florida Keys. We always like to say there, you know, at some point, some county council member in the Monroe County or city council member in Key West is going to have to say, you know what, we can't raise these roads anymore. We can't put in enough pumps. It's
too
expensive.
There's nothing to connect the roads.
And so, yeah, and so this part of town is no longer habitable. And that's going to be a really bad day for those mayors and those council members.
No, I think that's exactly right. People aren't dumb though, so they will begin to move out before it's up to the mayor to say I'm shutting the town down, and it's not just temporary. We can't live here anymore.
Right.
That's happening along the Louisiana coast in small communities, things like that. And I know some people are thinking that instead of rebuilding their homes in California, maybe they should look for a place to move, but I have a friend who moved from California to Colorado, and everybody's telling him to go away because fires seem to be chasing him.
Well, we have people moving here to Park City,
indeed,
to stay cool during the summer. There is we're seeing adaptation here. We have to wrap up. It's such a great pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Gary Yeo, Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Thanks again for taking the time to chat with us, and we hope we can loop back with you and talk some more in the future.
It would be a pleasure to do that. Thank you very much, like I said, for finding me, and you all and all your listeners, just stay safe and vote.
Thank you.
That's the perfect way to end this. Thanks so much, Dr. Yeo.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.